that these families are included. And in terms of other details, and I don't want to get too much into the details, but in terms of this work requirement that they're asking, you know, that women are not excluded as well, women who are housewives or who work at home or who are domestic workers are not excluded from this deal, and that day laborers and such are not excluded from the deal as well.
What about the issue that I hear so much about with people concerned about their families being split up? Are you hearing anything positive about a determination to keep families together?
I have not heard details about, you know, if they're gonna reduce the amount of time where you can petition your family, if people who have been deported already or who have been separated already, if they're gonna be able to get reunited. Again, LGBTQ families right now are not going to have the right to petition their partners, so those things really concern us.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what do you hope to accomplish today?
I think we want to send a very clear message that, you know, the Latino community is organized, that we've voted last year, like I said before, in huge numbers, that we're going to continue to register people to vote, that we're going to continue to mobilize voters, and that we're going to continue to raise our voices and to bring stories of the people who are directly affected by this lack of or this broken immigration system until this problem is resolved.
Karina Claudio is a lead organizer with Make the Road New York. She spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago.
Crops are all in, the beaches are rotting, the oranges are piled in.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. The news was produced in New York by Jose Santiago, Rebecca Miles, Linda Perry, and Lucas Reckhouse. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
My father's own father, he waded that river. They took all the money he made in his life.
Yeah. Something different, man.
What's up?
Something new.
This is Saigon.
Something special.
When I'm in New York City, I listen to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, Peace and Justice Radio. And when I'm not in New York, I listen to WBAI.org. So check it out. Listen and learn something. Peace.
They come to the ghetto to see what it is.
This is Shelton Walden of Walden's Pond, the weekly radio program heard every Sunday right here on WBAI. From 1 to 2 p.m., we discuss health, culture, and politics, and a lot more. I come to you with a very, very personal appeal for BAI to help us in our very, very difficult circumstances. What I want you to do is become a BAI buddy for my program. Fill out the secure online form on our website at WBAI.org. To donate $10 or more each month directly from your credit card or checking account, and you will get the members' perks card for discounts around the city posted on the WBAI website. You can donate in the name of Walden's Pond. Please do so. And that will help cut down on on-air fund drive days. Just go to our online donation site at WBAI.org. I'm Shelton Walden, and I thank you for helping out WBAI, Desperate Hour of Need.
On Sunday, April 14th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature award-winning poet, playwright, essayist, and recording artist, Carl Hancock Rux. Join us as we discuss many things, including upcoming Apollo Theater dates and his latest release, Homeostasis. That's Sunday, April 14th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Robert Knight, inviting you to stay tuned for this live edition of Earthwatch, in which we have a very special guest tonight in the person of Ken Gale. Stay tuned.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. Stop and see. When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. To know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. There's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Well, greetings everyone, and welcome back to Earthwatch. My name is Robert Knight, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. And we have a number of things to talk about during the course of this evening. Perhaps later on we'll be taking some phone calls at 212-650-5782. This is my second shakedown cruise here at our new studios at the City College. Oh. And we're learning the new quirks and progressing through broadcast. So I come to you with both joy and sadness tonight because of the recent loss of someone who was very important to my the formation of my visual sense and sense of imagination. Recently, we lost one of the great sequential artists of all time, I think, Carmine Infantino. And here on on a special visit to help understand, commemorate, and appreciate the work that Mr. Infantino did is Ken Gale. Many of you remember him from the late lamented Nuff Said comics book program on WBAI, and it's really good to have you in studio.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Robert.
Well, now, some of the earliest comic books from DC that I ever remember reading were drawn by Carmine Infantino. And for those who have had only a passing glance at comics, there used to be a fabulous world called Ran in a series called Adam Strange, with one of the sleekest looking uniforms I've ever seen, with a double jetpack on his back and cross white straps along the front. He was also the artist for The Flash. And in both series, there was a really elegant architectural sense of building design, much less the faces and bodies and so on. But Ken, why don't you, for those who knew and loved his work, as well as those who might have and still can, tell us about his work.
Well, what you brought up just now was the Frank Lloyd Wright influence.
Ah.
Carmine was a fan, and I mean, not literally a student, but he studied Frank Lloyd Wright. So that's one of the things you noticed. The other thing is he started in comics in the late 40s, just out of high school. He tried to start while he was still in high school. And Sheldon Mayer, the DC editor, said, him and Frank Giacoy showed up at the same time, "Are your parents working?" Okay, this is just after World War II. And he remembers Carmine sort of looking down and saying in a very low voice, "Yes," because he understood why Shelley asked the question. Because if your parents are working, I'm not going to hire you. All right? If your parents are not working, you need the money, then fine. Mm-hmm. And that was, he was good enough to be hired then, but he wasn't good enough to become a star. And Carmine felt, you know, study more, come back in a year. And I'm sure if you follow the advice I'm giving you right now, and he gave him a lot of advice, you'll get hired. And Carmine showed up a year later, to the day, alone, because his friend had gotten some background inking work with some of the lower-paying companies. And Carmine did follow the advice that Sheldon Mayer gave him and got hired. And by the early 50s, was working regularly, had plenty of work, doing quite well. When the Kefauver hearings happened and the Senate kind of, in its own way, shut down the comic book industry in 54, Carmine was still working. A lot of people, Gene Colan wasn't getting work. Right? He's great an
Gene
artist.
Colan. Oh,
you know, another recently departed.
Both shape and color.
Yeah, he died. He died about a year ago. And, I mean, here's Gene Colan knocking where Carmine was. He was, you know, one of the best. And then Carmine goes to art school. He's already a working artist and goes to art school. And he goes to a school of art and design and a few other places. And, School of Visual Arts. On 23rd Street. And his teacher did not like the fact that he was drawing comic books. You know, says, "You're too good of an artist to waste your talent doing these terrible things." And Carmine's like, "This is what I want to do." And he was one of the sort of the first wave of people who entered the comic book field not to go on to something else, but to stay in comics. Mm-hmm. So there was a little fanboy in him. And it's kind of important to me to think about the fact that there was a fanboy in him then, because I saw that in him when I got to know him over the last, now 10, 15 years, I guess. And so he goes to school, and his teacher acquaints him and helps him study the works of Degas and Modigliani and a lot of the Impressionists. So what else you saw in the backgrounds of the various planets that Adam Strange and whoever went to, because of course the Flash had a lot of alien stories, was learning that. So he was taking fine art and applying it to comics, because there's a when you do comics, the figure is the main thing. What the main character in the panel is doing is what you want the reader to focus on. But they're not doing it in a vacuum, and there's backgrounds. But you don't want the backgrounds to distract from the main figure. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the reader has to know, just, you know, looking through the panel, where is this happening? You know, what time of day and all, and various other aspects that the background tells you. So how do you give you enough detail and information without distracting from the foreground. Impressionism.
Yeah, I could almost see the buildings in my mind right now. Imagine in the background a building that is constructed of several sheets of paper separated from each other with a central body going through it with a rounded top. It's so right now that you said it. Frank Lloyd Wright, as a matter of fact.
And it's funny because I didn't notice it until he actually came out and told me when I interviewed him on Nuff Said right here on WBAI. And it was sort of like, duh. Yeah, it was this moment because I noticed, like, when Flash would run around, you know, the suburbs of Central City, you know, you would see the backgrounds and the outlines. But I didn't realize I was looking at Impressionism. You know, I was looking at comics, you know.
That's the thing about Once Upon a Time in comics. They were actually educational. I will always cherish that the first time I ever heard or read the word neutrino was in a DC Comics book drawn by Carmine Infantino.
And written by John Broome, most likely.
Yes, B-R-O-O-M-E.
Yes.
And he worked with Murphy Anderson, did he not?
Murphy Anderson inked Carmine on some things. Joe Giella inked him on other things. Most people felt Murphy was his best inker.
There was a running gag in many of the comics. In the background, you might see a tractor-trailer truck. And always somewhere in the story, much like Hitchcock at the beginning of a film, you would see a company named M.A. for Murphy Anderson.
Yeah. They did a lot. Now, Julie Schwartz, who's the editor of Flash and Adam Strange, and in fact, I think he was the editor of almost everything Carmine drew in the 50s and 60s. Yeah, but I would say he probably is. Anyway, he comes from a science fiction fandom in the 30s. He was the creator of the very first fanzine dedicated to science fiction ever, called The Time Traveler. And he was very much into science, and he wanted to make sure the science in any of his comics that he edited was correct. Mm-hmm. He also told his writers, no more than one coincidence per story. Because when you're...
An imaginary tale.
Well, when you're relying on deadlines and you have to do an entire story, plot and script in a couple days, you can fall into the trap of relying on coincidences to keep the story going. Mm-hmm. You'll see this in TV all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, TV is full of coincidences. And maybe it works in comedy. It just really detracts from drama. And I think Julie kind of let that thing, that rule aside when he got older. But back then, it was a very strong thing. So you were seeing strong writing and strong art.
With the sidebars of space, science, physics, mathematics, and so on, imagine in the bottom quarter of a page panel would be maybe three frames with a picture and like a really cool explanation of how that happened. Do you think that, whether with Julie Schwartz or with others, that was in part a reaction to the terrible storm of the censorship that preceded in the decade before?
I think there was something to that. And Julie was like, oh, I don't know. I mean, he often would disregard questions like that. But when he was a young editor in the late 40s, you didn't see that sort of thing.
For those who are not familiar with playing beheaded baseball and basically the McCarthy hearings for comics.
Yeah.
And tell people about what a terrible reactionary time that was in terms of creativity and such.
It was sort of the brainchild of Estes Kefauver, who was a senator from Tennessee. And he understood this new medium, television, and the power that it had. And so he used it to go after organized crime in 1952. It was very successful. and he became a presidential candidate, in consideration as a presidential candidate as a result of that. And then in 1954, he decided to go after the problem of juvenile delinquency. But does he mention poverty? Does he mention racism? Does he mention any of that? No. The only thing he talks about for these special sessions on juvenile delinquency, which was held in New York City, was comic books. The entire thing was an attack on comic books. And he had Bill Gaines, the publisher and editor of EC Comics, testifying. And, in fact, you can find the entire session online nowadays. It was broadcast live at the time on our municipal radio station before, when back when public radio was only KPFK and from Pacifica.
So this would be in the 1950s?
It's 1954. And there were two sessions, one with various experts like Frederick Wortham, basically a radio psychiatrist, and then the second session was various publishers, including Bill Gaines, who published horror comics. So they really went after horror comics.
I actually met Bill Gaines when I first came to New York City as a kid. He was one of the most gracious people. I had the boldness to walk up to Madison or Lexington Avenue to their headquarters.
It was Madison Avenue.
a souvenir paperback that he had a bunch of because it could not be published successfully, they figured, because it was about a year or so after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And it was Alfred E. Newman in a rocking chair, a la Kennedy. And I reminisce or mention Bill Gaines because, if I correctly remember, the evolution of Mad Magazine was based on a fierce journalistic independence from censorship.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, sure. The Mad started out as a comic book by Harvey Kurtzman, who was a humor writer, and he was basically complaining that he wasn't making enough money. He was editing the war books, which you really could say were anti-war books. I mean, there was no glamour in what was going on in those books, and the research was impeccable. Yeah. And there's a great cartoon John Severin did about him getting research about what happened in D-Day from Eisenhower. But at any rate, that didn't really happen. But Mad satirized everything, and there really wasn't any mass market satire magazine, and he satirized Archie Comics. And the Archie gang were a bunch of juvenile delinquents. Well, the person who was the head of Archie Comics, a guy by the name of John Goldwater, never forgave Bill Gaines for publishing that. And when the Comics Code happened, they basically made it illegal. The words horror and terror, you cannot have those words in a comic book title. And the best-selling titles of EC were Crypt of Terror and Vault of Horror. So he basically outlawed the two bestsellers there. He would, a lot of people say he was personally going after Bill Gaines. And Bill Gaines could not get any of his comics distributed. So then he went into what was back then called the Slicks, which he turned Mad the comic book into a magazine that we know it as today.
Well, I would also give Mad some praise because, like you refer to, the little bit of business in the background, the upstaging, in the dramatic sense of the main feature of a scene, an image. I remember that almost always in the course of one of the illustrated stories, there would be three little kids on their T-shirts. It would say J, A, and N. One was Asian, one was white, one was black. And so I thought Matt had an extraordinary leading sense of social consciousness. People think these are just cartoons and comic books, but there's a lot more going on than meets the eye.
The story Judgment Day, drawn by Joe Orlando, was an amazing story of an astronaut from whatever they called the Federation of Planets, United Planets, or whatever in the story. He was going to investigate the civilization of this other planet. Are they socially advanced enough to be worthy of joining this federation? And it was a civilization run by robots. And there were red robots and there were blue robots. And I forgot who ran, whether the red or the blue ran things. But let's say the red ran things. And so the red robots taking him around and showing him how wonderful their civilization is and how advanced they are. And then they take him, and then they shows the blue robots are doing all the menial work. Mm-hmm. And then he takes them to a robot factory. And the astronaut goes, your robots are exactly the same until you put the skin color on them.
Right.
And says, so why do you only have the blue robots do menial work? Well, because they're blue. And basically the astronaut goes, no, you're not advanced enough socially to join our federation. And the last panel is the astronaut going back to Earth, and he takes off his helmet, and he's black.
This is Earthwatch.
The comics code was going to reject the story. This was one of the last things that EC ever published. They were going to reject the story because he was black. And Bill Gaines said, if you reject this story, I am going to have a press conference, and I'm going to tell everybody why. So then they accepted the story.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. That's Ken Gale. And he is the producer of Nuff Said, which hopefully is not a prophetic title.
I would love to do it again. Although Jim Freund is going to have me do segments on his show.
Well, good. We are having a radio wake for Carmine Infantino. And there he was in the middle of this mix of transition, of innovation, of higher level of education in the comics. And
right. And then he went to art school to make comics better.
Yeah.
And I really, because there's a E-list of comic scholars, all right? It's international. And when somebody dies, people write about them. Mm-hmm. And you get sort of like a little bibliography. You know, when he was interviewed here, he said this. And when he was interviewed there, he said that, you know. And nobody says a word about Carmine. And I'm like, what's up with this? So I said, you know, usually there's comment here, and there isn't. And, well, that started a floodgate, and I've got several screens, all right, of just a list of the comments. People saying that he wasn't artistic enough to be worthy of our consideration, and other people, yes, he was. You know, just the influence of the Impressionists and Frank Lloyd Wright enough is worthy of scholarly discussion, not to mention the fact that he was the artist of the beginning of the Silver Age of comics. You can't dismiss that either. And then one person who turns out not to like him personally called him a hack, and now there's a big discussion of what a hack is and whether a hack is even worthy of discussion, of scholarly discussion, just as bad movies are discussed. In a scholarly way, you can discuss bad comics if you want. And there's one thing about Carmine is he got promoted to management in the late 60s, and he changed. And that little fanish boy I mentioned earlier was buried. And in 78, I did a comic book convention called Fireball, and I invited him. And he didn't want to show up because he knew a lot of people didn't like him, and he was kind of felt it was going to be – he was uncomfortable going to a convention. And he was very businesslike, and then suddenly he started asking me about what was going on in fandom because he used to communicate with fans in the early 60s. And all of a sudden I'm like, God, this is not the guy I've heard about. I mean, he just really loves the art form. And it's fans. And I'm like, wow, this is not the Carmine I've heard about. But it made sense because of what he had been doing. When he got fired by Time Warner or whatever it was by then.
Having been Kinney and then Time Warner.
Right.
And
so Kinney bought it from the Leibowitz family, and then they sold it to Warners, and then they merged with Time, and then AOL, and then God, or whatever, and he started drawing again, and his art was nothing like it had been. It was a mockery of his old work, and the people who inked him were really angry because they really weren't full pencils anymore. his pencils were so detailed. And now the people had to do it, had to finish the artwork. It wasn't just – because an inker goes over the pencils in ink and has to make sure everything's three-dimensional, that the stone looks like stone, flesh looks like flesh, hair looks like hair, trees look like trees. So you have to put all the textures in. And you have to make sure the foreground and the background are where they're supposed to be.
Well, you know, people evolve during their transit through life. And I would imagine this, what you call this transition, might have been concomitant with his additional responsibilities as an executive of a publishing company.
Yeah, because he's in the middle.
I mean, that's to
he's
be
got
expected.
Editors yelling at him for one reason, and then he has his higher-ups at Warner's yelling at him for a different reason, and he had to please them both.
What were the changes or the what was the ethos of the DC corral of comics during his tenure?
A lot of books got canceled. A lot of books got canceled before. Most people say now that they were never given a chance to succeed. They were canceled so quickly.
Do you think that upper management pressure, quarterly final bottom lines might have been a factor?
It could be. Now, this is a time period when the Batman TV show, all right, which boosted sales amazingly, all right, Batman was selling a million copies a month, which hadn't happened since the 40s. Superman was selling almost that. When the TV show ended, there was a huge nosedive, and very, very fast, and it kept going. I remember looking at sales figures that they canceled the Atom because it sold under 300,000. And then they were, just a couple years later, they canceled Aquaman because it was selling 150,000. So you can see this rapid decline in sales. And I don't think anything could have stopped that.
Well, you know, Ken, I think sometimes that movie, or in the case of the early Batman television show, that movie-related boosts of sales for the comics that provided the inspiration for the movies, I'm not sure that's always a good thing, because generally you get some executives having margaritas and blowing cokes over in L.A. Say, no, wait, no, how about this? I can see it now. The confrontation between the Batman and the Joker. I made you. No, you made me. And they just make up crap. That is inconsistent with the dramatic consistency of a narrative that people have come to feel some affinity to. Look at what happened to Batman with the recent movies. Look at the universe of destruction that was wreaked upon that empire in D.C. of Batman by Grant Morrison. you know, popularity has its place, but there's also dramatic and thematic continuity.
And as we all know, the source material is always better than the movie version. Mm-hmm. The books are always better. The original movie is always better than the remake. The comics are better than the movies about comics. I mean, it's almost always the case. I mean, Hollywood can't even adapt the Bible without changing it. So if they're going to change the Bible, then they're certainly not going to have qualms about changing a book or a comic book.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. We're speaking with Ken Gale of Nuff Said, and I think we have a little bit of time, Ken, in which we can take listener phone calls for those who are familiar with the art form or curious about it. Our number here is area code 212-650-5782. This is Earthwatch on WBAI, and our on-air phone number is 212-650-3782, and we'll be back with some more chat and you coming up right after this.
Look out below and see the grass.
that nice? You're the light that will shine at midnight tonight. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York. Thank you, Harsin. And we're here with Ken Gale of Nufzad, and we're commemorating the life and great work of one of the finest comics artists ever, Carmine Infantino. And we're taking your calls area code 212-650-5782. Whenever we come into this building, we have to wipe our cues because things like that happen. So 650-5782, and you are on the air. Hello. Huh. Hello, anybody there? Okay, the phone system works a little differently than we're used to here, so do be patient, and you are hopefully on the air.
Hello.
Welcome.
Yes. Tom from the Bronx.
Yes.
And you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and I'd like to say that when the comics had problems years ago, and the comics code came to be, it was because, I remember, because one kid killed another kid, and he was in jail, and all he wanted to do was read comics. Do you remember that story?
Well, it's no different from what's happening now with the shopping mall sprees I don't care about that individual story. I'm talking about the movies today, which are relatively in the same position that the Kefauver committee went after, and that is some irony. Kim, do you care to speak to that?
There's a book that came out many years ago called Children, Culture, and Controversy by Mark West, and basically, anything that a child can do with their own money is not necessarily what the parent would have done for the child. So if a kid wants to buy a comic book, he won't buy the comic book his parent would have bought for him, or the book, or whatever. And this has been going on since mass printing made things cheap enough for a kid to be able to afford to buy.
Yeah, but
there's always a parent group that springs up when they find out their kids are reading dime novels, or they're reading Hardy Boys, or they're listening to children's radio shows, or they're watching video games or whatever, to try to stop not the children from doing what they don't like, but from what they don't like from existing at all.
You know,
and they will find anything they can. So if every kid in America reads comics, they're not going to go, hey, all these valedictorians are reading comics, everybody should read comics. They'll go, no. A kid in jail was reading comics, so therefore comics are bad. You find what you need to find to justify whatever you need to justify. And when one kid in jail mentions comics, they'll never, ever talk to the valedictorians at every high school who are reading comics.
Perhaps we ought to have congressional hearings into the Bible, so that the readers of that book will stop smiting their enemies with righteous viciousness.
There's certainly an awful lot of hate that comes out of reading that
Bible.
Particular book, yes.
Yes. This is Earthwatch on WBAI. Robert Knight here with Ken Gale, and the number is 650-5782. Hello, you're on the air.
Huh?
You are on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, the various comic book cultures, you know, especially the undergrounds. Nobody ever brings them up.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't know. Basically speaking, I've been basically a great fan of Doctor Strange, but then I got very much tied up into the work of Stan Rodriguez.
Oh, yes, very gory. Motorbike hogs and heifers.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a lot more than that. It was incredibly versatile. When I went back to this webpage on The Last Gasp.
He's been popping up at conventions.
It was an incredible variety of stuff. He was a very versatile artist,
yeah.
Really.
Mm-hmm. He still is.
It's like calling Robert Williams a hot rod artist, you know?
Yes, I'm speaking about the formative images that I recall from my illicit reading of underground comics.
By the way, if he knew Bill Gaines, I wonder if he could tell me who in the world was Melvin. Who was Melvin?
An in-joke.
Huh?
He was an in-joke. He was nothing more than an in-joke and a name they liked using over and over again, and it became an in-joke.
So there was never originally a real Melvin?
No.
Well, thank you for the call and the reference to underground comics. My favorites among them were Sheridan and Schreier, who did very detailed, illustrated psychedelic, but not like woo, but very very interesting stories.
My favorites
have worked with the Fabulous Furries.
Furry Freak Brothers by Gilbert Shelton were always my favorites.
Mm-hmm. Well, lively discussion tonight. This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air. Hello. This is a phone system with a delay, so please keep your ears on the phone.
No, my ears are on the phone.
Welcome.
I'm here. The only thing about it, I just wanted to know what would you guys think about the concept of anime, in this case. How does that bring more life to comics, or its background, or something to that effect? What would you think of anime?
Well, anime... Osamu Tezuka, who created anime in Japan and manga, referred to anime as the greatest goodwill ambassador Japan has. It's kind of strange in that in America, when anime was first coming over in the 80s, it was only the either very violent or very sexy stuff that came over because they thought that's all anybody would want to know. And then Sailor Moon came out. And they found out girls were looking at anime, and the diversity of the field in Japan is tremendous. Anything you could find a video about, you could find an anime about, and so you had all this diversity. Whereas comics and animation in the U.S. were getting more and more limited as time was going on. In Japan, it was very, very broad. So independent comics, of course, had that great diversity of content. But they didn't have the distribution. And then suddenly the book companies and various companies discovered anime and they discovered manga, and it became very big and probably oversaturated the market and all that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of really, really great anime that has come out of Japan, just as a lot of great independent comics here. It's a very different way of doing things.
You know, the only reason why I asked that question was because, as Robert geniusly pointed out, that there were other, that the movies, about the way the movie industry sort of takes a character and then lets the directors or lets whatever it is, the studio guys, get their hands on something and then rip it apart to shreds. Witness the Superman, the pre-Superman movie, the one that was before the one that's coming out this year. But I just only wanted to mention this in what context, because there are characters that seem to be ignored by film studios. I mean, one like, say, the Green Arrow, and specifically, I mean, that was one that came to my mind, especially as being the doppelganger for the Bruce Wayne character. It seemed like he always got the better, always got the better thing with the studio.
Billionaire who goes into exile, who goes into eclipse and learns a great many things about weaponry and combat, mm-hmm. and comes back as a costumed hero whom nobody recognizes, they think, because they put a little mask on.
Yeah.
But
and in fact, in the late 60s, Neil Adams was off quoted as saying that there are no bad characters, only bad ways of doing them. Mm. And so somebody goes, "Oh yeah, Green Arrow," and Neil goes, "I can make Green Arrow interesting."
No, but I'm just saying,
because
in the DC universe, you might even have gone to the conclusion that the doppelganger, or the what you would call the opposite character for Bruce Wayne, was the character Deadshot, and I'm saying he was never really brought to. He was mentioned in the anime. That's why I brought up the question beforehand. But never was used in any of the main character movies, and yet he is the perfect doppelganger for Bruce Wayne.
A very fine part of the discussion you've led us into. I would proffer this, not so much contemporaneously, but in the very first and early days, I can think of one transition to moving image from comics that I found simpatico, and that was Smallville in the beginning.
I sort of It had moments, and then it would like let you down, and then it had another moment, and then it let you down, and I just got tired of that up and down stuff with Smallville.
Well, this is Earthwatch. We're speaking with Ken Gale and the listeners at 212-650-5782. And Ken, I guess I'd like to bring it to a consummation, a conclusion, a wrap-up about the state of consuming artistic media, and again with a special reflection of affection for the late, great Carmine Infantino.
I don't know where to end. How to start the ending? The comics field tends to, you have sort of like the superhero fans on one hand, and the people who, oh, I would never touch a superhero comic, and if it's a comic of superheroes that they like, they say it's not a superhero comic, like say Watchmen, and if it wasn't for artists like Carmine, that field would have been so much lesser than it ever was. He enriched the field. He probably shouldn't have become a boss, but at the same time, you know, he did some good there, I suppose, or he felt he could. And in the last few years of his life, he would go to conventions and sign autographs and talk to kids, talk to grown-up kids. And he was a much friendlier person in the last few years of his life. And I'm glad that people got to see that side of him, because I got to see glimpses of it while, you know, when he let his guard down. And it was nice that everybody got to see it. And he was 87 years old when he passed away, so he had a long life. And maybe those comic scholars who want to call him a hack and then have to discuss whether a hack is good or bad, it may take a long time for people to appreciate what they lost.
Well, I couldn't have said it better, and I thank you for the insight, and I regret for the world and for your own personal friendship and relationship with Carmine Infantino, his passing. But as I always say about Michael Jackson, too, that was not a tragic life or a failure.
Yeah, right.
Another person who so changed the world, and I think the same goes for Carmine. And I'm glad to have been around during the time that he was.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me on. It was great to chat comics with you, and thanks for the opportunity to have the Nuff Said part of my personality come out again.
Well, thank you, Ken Gale of the Once and Future Nuff Said. I'm Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch. We'll be back with more.
WBAI, New York.
Alrighty, come on, you.
Maggie, Maggie, Maggie.
The Larks. Maggie, Maggie, Maggie. Out, out, out. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. And what a lovely evening we have. But that machine is insubordinate. We're commemorating the loss of Carmine Infantino and in some cases celebrating the loss of Maggie Thatcher, the invader of the hemisphere, the violator of the Rio Treaty with the invasion of the Malvinas in Argentine country, and the deaths of so many Irish patriots and so many wars, and what do they call it? Low-intensity conflicts. So there will be a commemoration of the life and work of Margaret Thatcher this Saturday at Rocky Sullivan's in Red Hook. And I think my pals John McDonough and Randy Credico and a bunch of other creative people, the work of Brian Moore, will be on display, one of the great artists who is also among the late recently departed. So Rocky Sullivan, Saturday, Maggie, 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 out, 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 bash, bash, bash. So you might want to join that, have a little bit of fun. And what else is happening? Well, we'll be back next week at midnight for yet another thrilling edition of Earthwatch. And I've gotten so many calls and emails and comments. Last week presented a special mix contrasting the Nobelicity of Barack Obama and Martin Luther King. And after much calumny and attacks for being early critical of President Barack Obama and what easily could have been seen as a trend towards corporatism, and especially as it is our responsibility here at Pacifica Radio to speak about peace and the ways of war, which was evident from the very beginning with the exponential escalation of the use of drones and the troubling that Obama did of the number of troops in Afghanistan. And now, to the shock of the belated conscious progressive, some elements of the community who had knowingly or not sold their soul to the Democratic Party, choosing the evil of two lessers and not maintaining the independent movement of power that comes from unions, that comes from community organizing. And I don't mean Obama-style community organizing, the corporate community, and in particular the churches. Which is why tonight I would like to leave you with this, and that is yet another highly important and underestimated or underpresented part of the work of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And this is from Detroit, where he speaks about the issue of freedom and institutional conscience. And so thank you for listening tonight. This is Earthwatch on WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and here now, Martin Luther King at the Freedom Hall in Detroit, speaking about things that matter.
And now, my friends, let the trumpet sound, let the bells ring, let the drums roll. Lay out the red carpet. Here he comes, America's beloved freedom fighter, Martin Luther King.
good friend, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, and all of the officers and members of the Detroit Council of Human Rights, distinguished platform guests, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot begin to say to you this afternoon how thrilled I am, and I cannot begin to tell you the deep joy that comes to my heart as I participate with you in what I consider the largest and greatest demonstration for freedom ever held in the United States. I can assure you that what has been done here today will serve as a source of inspiration for all of the freedom-loving people of this nation.
Dr. King, you have to stand above those things.
I think that is something else that must be said, because it is a magnificent demonstration of discipline. With all of the thousands and hundreds of thousands of people engaged in this demonstration today, there has not been one reported incident of violence. I think this is a magnificent demonstration of our commitment to nonviolence in this struggle for freedom all over the United States. And I want to commend the leadership of this community for making this great event possible, and making such a great event possible through such disciplined channels. September the 22nd, 1862, to be exact, a great and noble American, Abraham Lincoln, signed an executive order which was to take effect on January the 1st, 1863. This executive order was called the Emancipation Proclamation, and it served to free the Negro from the bondage of physical slavery. But 100 years later, the Negro in the United States of America still isn't free. But now, more than ever before, America is forced to grapple with this problem, for the shape of the world today does not afford us the luxury of an anemic democracy. The price that this nation must pay for the continued oppression and exploitation of the Negro or any other minority group is the price of its own destruction, for the hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out, and we must act now before it is too late. The events of Birmingham, Alabama, and the more than 60 communities that have started protest movements since Birmingham are indicative of the fact that the Negro is now determined to be free. For Birmingham tells us something in glaring terms. It says first that the Negro is no longer willing to accept racial segregation in any of its dimensions. We have come to see that segregation is not only sociologically untenable, it is not only politically unsound, it is morally wrong and sinful. Segregation is a cancer in the body politic, which must be removed before our democratic health can be realized. Segregation is wrong because it is nothing but a new form of slavery covered up with certain niceties of complexity. Segregation is wrong because it is a system of adultery perpetuated by an illicit intercourse between injustice and immorality. And in Birmingham, Alabama, and all over the South and all over the nation, we are simply saying that we will no longer sell our birthright of freedom for a mess of segregated pottage. In a real sense, we are through with segregation now, henceforth, and forevermore. Struggle tell us something else. They reveal to us that the Negro has a new sense of dignity and a new sense of self-respect. For years, I think we will all agree that probably the most damaging effect of segregation than what it has done to the soul of the segregated as well as the segregator. It has given the segregator a false sense of superiority, and it has left the segregated with a false sense of inferiority. And so, because of the legacy of slavery and segregation, many Negroes lost faith in themselves, and many felt that they were inferior. But then something happened to the Negro. Circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. And so his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. And even his economic life was rising through the growth of industry. The influence of organized labor expanded educational opportunities, and even his cultural life was rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. And all of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Negro masses. Negro masses all over began to re-evaluate themselves. The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children, and that all men are made in his image, and that figuratively speaking, every man from a base black to a treble white is significant on God's keyboard. And so the Negro could now unconsciously cry out with the eloquent poet, "Fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man." But these events that are taking place in our nation tell us something else. They tell us that the Negro and his allies in the white community now recognize the urgency of the moment. I know we have heard a lot of cries saying, "Slow up and cool off." We still hear these cries. They are telling us over and over again that you're pushing things too fast. And so they're saying, "Cool off." Well, the only answer that we can give to that is that we've cooled off all too long, and that is the danger. There's always a danger if you cool off too much that you will end up in a deep freeze. Well, they're saying you need to put on brakes. The only answer that we can give to that that the motor is now cranked up and we are moving up the highway of freedom toward the city of equality. And we can't afford to stop now because our nation has a date with destiny. We must keep moving. Then that is another cry. They say, why don't you do it in a gradual manner? Well, gradualism is little more than escapism and do-nothingism, which ends up in standstillism. We know that our brothers and sisters in Africa and in Asia are moving with jet-like speed toward the goal of political independence. And in some communities, we are still moving at horse and buggy pace toward the gaining of a hamburger and a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. And so we must say now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to transform this pending national elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. Now is the time to lift our nation. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of racial justice. Now is the time to get rid of segregation and discrimination. Now is the time. So this social revolution taking place can be summarized in three little words. They are not big words. One does not need an extensive vocabulary to understand them. They are the words all here now. We want all of our rights. We want them here and we want them now. This is the meaning. Now, the other thing that we must see about this struggle is that, by and large, it has been a nonviolent struggle. Let nobody make you feel that those who are engaged or who are engaging in the demonstrations in communities all across the South are resorting to violence. These are few in number. We've come to see the power of nonviolence. We've come to see that this method is not a weak method. For it's the strong man who can stand up amid opposition, who can stand up amid violence being inflicted upon him and not retaliate with violence. You see, this method has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience. And he just doesn't know what to do. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you develop the quiet courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense likes to go to jail. But if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they are worth dying for. And I submit to you that if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. Yeah. This method has wrought wonders. As a result of the nonviolent Freedom Ride movement, segregation in public transportation has almost passed away absolutely in the South. As a result of the sit-in movement at lunch counters, more than 285 cities have now integrated their lunch counters in the South. I say to you, there's power in this method. And I think by following this approach, it will also help us to go into the new age that is emerging with the right attitude. For nonviolence not only calls upon its adherents to avoid external physical violence, but it calls upon them to avoid internal violence of spirit. It calls on them to engage in that something called love. And I know it is difficult sometimes. When I say love at this point, I'm not talking about an affectionate emotion. It's nonsense to urge people, oppress people, to love their oppressors in an affectionate sense. I'm talking about something much deeper. I'm talking about a sort of understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. We're coming to see now, the psychiatrists are saying to us, that many of the strange things that happen in the subconscious, many of the inner conflicts are rooted in hate. And so they are saying, love will perish. But Jesus told us this long time ago, and I can still hear that voice crying through the vista of time, saying, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you. And that is still a voice saying to every potential Peter, put up your sword. History is replete with the bleached bones of nations. History is cluttered with the wreckage of communities that failed to follow this command. And isn't it marvelous to have a method of struggle where it is possible to stand up against an unjust system, fight it with all of your might, never accept it, and yet not stoop to violence and hatred in the process. This is what you have. Now that is a magnificent new militancy within the Negro community all across this nation. And I welcome this as a marvelous development. The Negro over America is saying he's determined to be free, and he is militant enough to stand up. But this new militancy must not lead us to the position of distrusting every white person who lives in the United States. There are some white people in this country who are as determined to see the Negro free as we are to be free. This new militancy must be kept within understanding boundaries. And then another thing I can understand, we've been pushed around so long. We've been the victims of lynching mobs so long. We've been the victims of economic injustice so long, still the last tide and the first fight all over this nation. And I know the temptation. I can understand from a psychological point of view why some caught up in the clutches of the injustices surrounding them almost respond with bitterness and come to the conclusion that the problem can't be solved within, and they talk about getting away from it in terms of racial separation. But even though I can understand it psychologically, I must say to you this afternoon that this isn't the way. Black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy. will allow me to say to you this afternoon that God is not interested merely in the freedom of black men and brown men and yellow men. God is interested in the freedom of the whole human race. And I believe that with this philosophy and this determined struggle, we will be able to go on in the days ahead and transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. As I move toward my conclusion, you're asking, I'm sure, what can we do here in Detroit to help in the struggle in the South? Well, there are several things that you can do. One of them you've done already, and I hope you will do it in even greater dimensions before we leave this meeting. Now, the second thing that you can do to help us down in Alabama and Mississippi and all over the South is to work with determination to get rid of any segregation and discrimination in Detroit. Realizing that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we've got to come to see that the problem of racial injustice is a national problem. No community in this country can boast of clean hands in the area of brotherhood. Now, in the North, it's different in that it doesn't have the legal sanction that it has in the South. But it has its subtle and hidden form. And it exists in three areas. In the area of employment discrimination, in the area of housing discrimination, and in the area of de facto segregation in the public schools. And we must come to see that de facto segregation in the North is just as injurious as the actual segregation in the South. So if you want to help us in Alabama and Mississippi and over the South, do all that you can to get rid of the problem here. And then we also need your support in order to get the civil rights bill that the president is offering passed. And that's a reality. Let's not fool ourselves. This bill isn't going to get through if we don't put some work in it and some determined pressure. And this is why I've said that in order to get this bill through, we've got to rouse the conscience of the nation, and we ought to march to Washington more than 100,000 in order to say that we are determined, and in order to engage in a nonviolent protest to keep this issue before the conscience of the nation. And if we will do this, we will be able to bring that new day of freedom into being. If we will do this, we will be able to make the American dream a reality. And I do not want to give you the impression that it's going to be easy. There can be no great social gain without individual pain. Before the victory for brotherhood is won, some will have to get scarred up a bit. Before the victory is won, some more will be thrown into jail. Before the victory is won, some, like Medgar Evers, may have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children and their white brothers from an eternal psychological death, then nothing can be more redemptive. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names. But we must go on with the determination and with the faith that this problem can be solved. And so I go back to the South not in despair. I go back to the South not with a feeling that we are caught in a dark dungeon that will never lead to a way out. I go back believing that the new day is coming. And so this afternoon I have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day, right down in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to live together as brothers. I have a dream this afternoon that one day, little white children and little Negro children will be able to join hands as brothers and sisters. I have a dream this afternoon that one day, men will no longer burn down houses in the Church of God simply because people want to be free. I have a dream this afternoon that there will be a day that we will no longer face the atrocities that Emmett Till had to face or Medgar Evers had to face, but that all men can live with dignity. I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, but they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job. Yes, I have a dream this afternoon that one day in this land the words of Amos will become real. Justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I have a dream this evening that one day we will recognize the words of Jefferson that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have a dream this afternoon.
Oh, Robert, you leave me in this unfortunate position where I must terminate this speech before its conclusion, because it's 1:30, and we must present our next program here at WBAI New York, which is Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 3 o'clock. Lister, or a reasonable facsimile, but now it's Hour of the Wolf here on WBAI New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, writer Catherine Lundoff appears, courtesy of recording. Well, actually, the whole show is recorded this week. Stay tuned, and I'll explain the whole thing. And once again, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And I have pre-recorded this show today, same day as broadcast, for a number of reasons. One of which is that the main part of the show was pre-recorded already, and it just, well, it became a lot easier to fit into my week this way. But let us not be timely as a result, double negatives notwithstanding. First, let me do a couple of announcements here. Next Wednesday, that would be a week from tonight, even though this is technically Thursday morning, on April 17th. At the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, two wonderful writers, Richard Bowes. Rick Bowes, if you were listening to the show last week, you know how good he is. And, well, there's just no not going. Here I am again. It's double negative day. Rick Bowes, winner of two World Fantasy Awards, an International Horror Guild Award, and a Million Writer Award. Recent and forthcoming short story appearances include the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Icarus, Lightspeed, and the anthologies Ghosts, Reason, Haunting. Just tons and tons of books. His latest stuff is that he has out now, which he read on the air last week, and you can still find on the WBAI archive, The Queen, The Cambion, and Seven Others, which is a collection of short stories, his classic novel, Minions of the Moon, and then finally, If Angels Fight. Not finally, but I mean, just all this stuff is coming out now. So do go meet Rick. And actually, I believe I will be there as well. Usually Gordon Linsner has been covering these for me because it's very difficult for me to go to the KGB readings and then wait, you know, 4 or 5 hours after that, hang out and go do the radio show. It was difficult enough when it was at 120 Wall Street. But now that we're up at CCNY on 130 umpteenth Street, it's even harder. But this one I intend to get to. Why? I'll explain that in a minute as well. The other reader is also a frequent guest to Hour of the Wolf, although it's been a little while for her, Alaya Dawn Johnson, who is the author of the Spirit Binders series, which included Racing the Dark in the Burning City, and also the Zephyr Hollis novels, Moonshine and Wicked City. So if you love your 1920s speakeasy stories with a bit of vampirism thrown in, those are the ones for you. Her first official young adult book, The Summer Prince, is just out. Kirkus gave it fine, quote, luminous review. And she's currently following up on a follow-up YA novel. And again, this information is good for next Wednesday night, April 17th at 7 p.m. at the KGB Bar, 85 East 4th Street, which is just off of 2nd Avenue upstairs. I hope to be there recording it. If I'm not recording it, Gordon Linsner will be, but we'll be there. And admission is free. I advise showing up early because these things do fill up, and with a lineup like that, well, why not? Now, why can I make it to that reading next week and not generally make it to the KGB readings? Well, our transmitter, the WBAI transmitter, will be off. But wait, hold your fear. This is not related in any way, shape, or form to the famed or infamous WBAI transmitter fund and the problems that we have been facing on that. This is Empire State Building maintenance. This happens every few years. When I was on the air from 5 to 7 a.m., it never affected me because the transmitter generally comes back on a little before 5 a.m. It goes off at 1 a.m. and comes back about 5 for 4 or 5 nights in a row. Occasionally, they only do 3 nights and then we come back early. It's an unknown. But now that I am on in this time slot, Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, 1:30 till 3 a.m., all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, we always had to do that. What a pain. Anyway, so we're off the air. Hour of the Wolf is off the air at least next week. That's the bad news. And the good news is that I'll be able to make it to the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading again. So let's see, the next NYRSF reading, that's my reading series, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, will be, by the way, May 7th, and I will tell you much more about that as the date approaches. Okay, now our guest this morning is Catherine Lundoff from Minneapolis. She had originally contacted me about getting an opportunity to do a New York Review of Science Fiction reading, as a matter of fact. And I said, well, we're a little bit booked up on that, but hey, how about a radio show? We get 30 or 40 people coming to the NYRSF reading, sometimes more. Gotta have at least as many listening to the radio, and she was quite good with that. And actually, she's a bit of an old hand at being a guest on radio programs. She had just been on KFAI for International Working Women's Day. KFAI is the Minneapolis listener-sponsored radio station. Not a Pacifica affiliate, I don't believe, but nonetheless, a fine, fine station that also, by the way, has a presence of science fiction in its programming with shows produced by Dave Rom, who's been there for many, many years. And Catherine, like Rick Bowes, who was with us last week, this is totally coincidental, is a person who has books published from Lethe Press. That's L-E-T-H-E, which is edited by Steve Berman. And she has 5 books currently in print. I'm looking at her website right now, and it says, listen to her International Women's Day show, Witches, Werewolves, and Starship Captains. I mean, what's not to like about that? And that also featured Rachel Pollack, another favorite friend here at WBAI Radio. To find out more about her website and such things, she is at CatherineLundoff.com, CatherineLundoff. This interview was recorded on March 9th. She will read a complete short story of a Poe nature, Poe as in the raven, etc. And then a segment from the second book in her werewolf novel series. The first one was Silver Moon, so we'll get a tease for book number two. So, without further ado, set your Wayback Machine and enjoy the interview.